welcome to Keys of the Kingdom on the Sabbath Hour. Brother Gregory and I talk about the Kingdom of God. That's what I do all the time. I do it on a regular basis, and I do it in every place I go. You talk to me about 5 minutes, and I'm somehow or other moving the conversation over to the Kingdom of God. And the reason why is nobody seems to know what the Kingdom of God really is all about. It's about the right to be ruled by God. All the rights of man are endowed by God. This is a fundamental premise that we find in early America when they were talking about the rights of men. We are endowed by our Creator with certain unalienable rights. That's where they come from. The rights that governments have come from men. And most of the time, men give those rights to government through contract. And that's a very interesting concept of contractually creating governments, because according to the Bible, we're to make no covenants with them nor with their gods. Now, certainly we can make contracts with individuals, make agreements, hey, I'll do this for you, you do that, and I'll do this, etc., etc. But in Exodus 23:32, which we talked about a little bit in the last show on 10 laws, says, thou shalt make no covenants with them nor with their gods. And we've talked briefly about that. Who are their gods? What are they talking about here when they're talking about gods? Well, the word gods there is Elohim, and people like to refer to God as being the God of heaven. But the reality is that the same Elohim is the same word you see translated into the small G-O-D-S, gods. It's just the translators decide, this one we're going to make big G, and this one we're going to make plural and small g. But the original word in the original text is pretty much the same. And that's because the word doesn't mean God in heaven or the divine God or divinity or the creator. It simply means ruling judge. It means the one having the power to judge fact and law. The ruling judge over you who makes law, the lawmaker. That's what we're not supposed to make covenants with, men who can become our lawmakers. Why? Because it's our responsibility to tend to the weightier matters of law, judgment, mercy, and faith. Now, it's amazing. You know, I've told the story 100 times now that in a room full of ministers and pastors, I asked them, what did Jesus call the weightier matters? And they didn't know a single one. All along the tour that I did this year, earlier this year, the whirlwind tour, went to about 30 states and talked to people all over the country. I kept asking that question. Only one guy in Minnesota seemed to come up with the answer as to what Christ called the weightier matters, which is, and he begins with law. But of course, you go to most churches, oh, they've done away with the law. We don't need the law anymore. Jesus said in order to obtain eternal life, you had to keep the law. But in the churches today, oh, you don't have to keep the law. Now, you tell me that ain't Satan. Who's running the churches today? Satan is running the churches, the adversary, someone who is against everything that Christ says. And over again, if you start looking at the eschatologies of these churches and their doctrines, you'll find that they're contradicting what Christ actually said. But most of the people who go to them never really actually study the Bible as if they want to know the truth. They want to know the information there so that they can use it against somebody else, so they can justify themselves, so that they can be called real smart or whatever. But the reality is that they're not really looking for the truth. If they were really looking for the truth, they'd find it. Now, some of the people probably listening on this show or listening to the recording that we're going to make after the show, maybe they're looking for the truth, because that's what we want to talk about. Thou shalt make no covenants with them nor with their gods, with their ruling judges. Now, we have a video I'm working on that will show you some pictures of some of these judges who sit in judgment of men and rule over them and exercise authority one over the other. But it wasn't to be that way with those who followed Christ. It wasn't that way with those who followed Moses, and it wasn't that way with those who followed Abraham. And those men set men free so that no one could rule over them but God. Didn't mean that they could go and do anything they wanted. Or they murdered, or they killed, or they stole. They might be answerable to society. And then 10 men, 12 men would get together and decide fact and law and judge these men. They'd do it very carefully, because if they judge wrongly, then the judgment is upon them. And that's very important to understand. But today, judges make mistakes all the time, and they don't have to pay for that mistake. And if they send somebody to jail for 20 years and they found out that they owe you wrong, you know, you didn't listen to the evidence, you know, you didn't allow the evidence that would have proved this man innocent, you made a judgment call that was incorrect, and you sent this man to jail for 20 years, you robbed him of 20 years of his life because you were incorrect, does that judge have to pay? No. Do you guys have to pay? All you guys made covenants with that judge. Yeah, I tell a story about a guy who was going to college, and he was really short on money, and his roommate left, and he didn't get the hours at the work he was getting. He's falling behind on his rent, and he was literally starving himself, trying to finish his schoolwork and juggle jobs and pay the rent. And he was in an auditorium, and somebody left their purse there in the seat, and he saw there was money in it, and he grabbed the purse and ran out. And somebody saw him, and the cops came to his door the next day, and as soon as they came to the door, he confessed, "Yeah, I took the money, I paid my rent with it, I threw the purse away." He was tried and sent to jail for 3 years. The woman never got her purse back, she never got her money back, and the people had to pay $25,000 a year to keep this man in jail. And that's the justice system? Amazing. That's what goes on every day in the justice system. It's become an industry where they put people in jail at your expense, teach them nothing but introduce them to more violence and crime usually, and nobody who was actually injured gets any recompense, because you have chosen judges who exercise authority one over the other, judges who are gods. These are the gods many that Paul was talking about. This is what they're talking about when they're talking about gods in the New Testament and Old Testament. And we talked before in an earlier show, I'm pretty sure on this radio broadcast, I've done 2.5 hours of broadcasting already today, but we have an article on it where the apotheos, the originator of gods, is the president of the United States. It was that way in Rome. People talk about, oh, well, the Roman emperors thought they were gods. Well, they are gods. They are ruling judges. They don't usually sit in the courtroom themselves, but they get to appoint all the federal judges throughout the United States. That's the job of the president of the United States. And that's one of the jobs that the emperor of Rome wanted too. He wanted to be able to appoint all the judges throughout the Roman Empire, all the imperial judges. We would call them federal judges today, but they would call them imperial judges back then. Imperator in the Latin means commander-in-chief. And the commander-in-chief wanted the job of apotheos, appointer of gods, appointer of judges. If you went into court, you would address the judge as God. You would use the word theos, or you'd use the word Elohim in the Hebrew court, but that's what you would actually use. Even in the Old Testament, you'll find where they just couldn't get away with translating Elohim God, so they had to translate a judge. It's very clear that it was judges. It's talking about crimes and bringing people before the judge. And that's what it means. Thou shalt make no covenants with them, nor with their ruling judges. Don't make any agreements with them, because you're giving these men power and you will corrupt them. Men shouldn't have that kind of power. Now, how did they judge matters? They judged it with a 10-12-man jury. 10 elders in a congregation formed a jury. The minister made it 11, and his minister made it 12. And if you didn't get a fair trial in Israel, you could appeal to the cities of refuge, which weren't actually cities. they were, you're appealing upwards amongst these ministers who were servants of servants of servants to say, hey, I didn't get a fair trial. You know, these guys are all worked up emotionally, and you know, they've decided my guilt before they even tried me, and they're not listening to the evidence. If you appeal to the cities of refuge, the ministers on farther up in this line of a network of servants of servants of servants, then they might let you off. And of course, occasionally that could be subject to bribes, and of course that's what happened, is that, and instead of the people working this out saying, oh, well, I'm not gonna, you know, tending to the weightier matters is a job for everybody, instead of doing that, they said, oh, let's just elect a guy who's a really good guy and make him in charge of appointing the judges from the top down. We'll make him king. He ended up being in charge of the tax collectors too. See, there were no tax collectors in Israel for 400 years. The entire government was run by free will offerings. Unless you live in a government like that, you don't live in a free government. You live in a government that exercises authority one over the other, which is contrary to what Christ said to do. Christ said not to be that way. But every single church I know, that's the kind of government they are in, and that's the kind of government they're looking for. They're even trying to elect a different ruling judge. If you, as I said before, if you go to a U.S. government website that talks about the Capitol Dome, the picture in the roof of the Capitol Dome is called the Apotheos. Apotheos. Apotheosis. The appointer of gods. That's what is the name of the painting. It was painted by Constantine Bermudi, who was sent over here from the Vatican to paint that mural in the Capitol Dome. And that's the name of the painting. The appointer of gods. And if you go on the U.S. government website, it states, quote, the painting raises Washington to the rank of God. That's actually what it states right there. And they're talking about George Washington because he's in the painting. Now, he didn't have anything to do with the painting, but you know, this is later on in the 1800s when it was painted. But that's the history of it. So, every president has the right to appoint all the judges, and so every president is a god and an appointer of gods and the apotheos of the United States. And the same thing goes on in every other country. There's always somebody who appoints these judges. But in a free government, you're the judge. This is why Jesus says, is it not written that ye also are gods? Now, he's not talking about divinity. He's not talking about the creator. But you have the right to judge. What? Fact and law. That was written into the Constitution of most states, or many of the states. I think it's actually most states. In one form or another, it'd be most states. The juries have the right to decide fact and law. And I have a whole series that I was going to put together on this. I've never had the time to do it because I'm doing radio programs and making a living and all those things. But I followed that up, and I have a series of letters to a local judge and then to the head of all the judges in the state of Oregon. And I went back and forth, and I was baiting them a little bit to get them to make a certain admissions and confessions. I mean, they do it all the time. Might as well we do it with them. And the judge kind of pegged what I was doing, and he actually was not totally unsympathetic. But he told me that he couldn't tell me the answer. He didn't say he didn't know it. He says, I can't tell you the answer. So he put me on to the administrator of all the judges throughout the state of Oregon, which is a woman, who is the administrator of all the courts. And that right there was telling me the answer, is these are all administrative courts. They're all administrative courts. They've been that way since 1911 in Oregon, and most states followed around that same period, that you're just dealing with administrative courts. You can't hardly get in a common law court in the United States. I mean, most of you don't have a right to be in a common law court because you don't understand the common law and you've done all kinds of things that keep you from the common law. They're unalienable rights, but you can lose access to them if a guy goes into jail. he has the right to do all kinds of things, but he can't do them because he can't get past the bars. So there's all kinds of bars and all kinds of restrictions. So we only have an hour to talk about this, but making no covenants would be including making no constitutions. Yeah, making no constitutions, because the Constitution is a covenant. It's a contract. It's an agreement. As a matter of fact, the United States Constitution is not much different than electing Saul. But we'll talk a little bit about what's wrong with the Constitution, and people who get all offended at that shouldn't, because there was a huge debate at the time that the Constitution was written up. It was actually the extremely unpopular document. Had it been put to a popular vote, it would have been voted down. Historians agree to that. There isn't any argument in history that had it, because they actually debate that. They say, well, if we put this to a popular vote, it'll be voted down. So they never put it to a popular vote. And the Supreme Court has ruled that the people weren't a party to the Constitution. That's right. You weren't a party to the Constitution. And people say, well, it says we the people. Yeah, but you didn't have a right to vote to it. You weren't a party to it. So why do you think we the people means you? The people. It didn't. It didn't mean the people. It meant the names at the bottom of the agreement. And those men who signed it at the bottom of the agreement didn't have any right to sign for the states. That's why it had to be ratified by the states. Until then, the only ones in the United States, the only ones who were a part of the United States, the only one who had any agreement with this Constitution were the names at the bottom of the sheet. That's we the people. We the people of the United States. That's us, the guys who signed this. Nobody else. Nobody else anywhere in America were a part of to that agreement. Then the states agreed to what they were agreeing to by ratification. The problem is the states had already made a previous agreement called the Articles of Confederation. And in the Articles of Confederation, it said they could not change these Articles of Confederation without unanimous consent of all the states. All the states had to agree to any changes at all. And, of course, the Constitution of the United States wasn't just any changes. It was a complete overhaul and reversal and change. So was the Constitution of the United States implemented with the unanimous agreement of all the states? Actually, no. They didn't all agree. There were several states that did not agree, and they put it into place anyway. So is that legal? Is that legal to do that? Actually, it's not legal to do that. And it was referred to as a revolution. But who was revolting? Was it the people? No, it was the government was revolting. The government was saying, we're going to have this Constitution of the United States, even though we haven't all agreed to it, and that's a violation of the Articles of Confederation. And we're going to do this, and we're not going to let the people vote on it because it really doesn't have anything to do with the people. Actually, you know, Madison and several others argued that point. It just doesn't have anything to do with the people. That's why we're not going to have them vote on it. This has to do with an agreement between the states. But of course, this is way back then is when they're doing this. This things have changed. It's an organic constitution, so things have changed. But so we the people had nothing to do with the general population. They didn't have any right to decide whether or not the Constitution was going to go into place. It was referred to as a quiet revolution. I can give you the quotes. And actually, if you read Contracts, Covenants, and Constitutions, we go into this in great detail. It's a book that's free to download on the Internet. And it will go through an awful lot of stuff that most people don't even know about their own history. If the Constitution was so unpopular with all Americans at that time, why is it so popular with everybody now? Well, actually, it's not all that popular with everybody now, because they don't even pay any attention to it, seemingly. And, of course, it's still there, but you're all under administrative law. And how did you get underneath there? Well, the Constitution allows for one thing that is guaranteed, is that you have a right to contract. And it also created the Judiciary Act of 1789. If you read Section 19, you'll see why everybody's in administrative courts, because everybody's involved in activity. There is no remedy for it, common law. Here, I'll read something. I think this is out of History of the United States by James Truslow Adams. He's writing, just as the revolutionary Adams opposed the Constitution in Massachusetts, so did Patrick Henry in Virginia, and the contest in most important states of all was prolonged and bitter. He who in Stamp Act days had proclaimed that there should be no Virginians or New Yorkers, but only Americans, now declaimed as violently against the preamble of the Constitution because it began, "We the people of the United States," instead of "We the states." Like many, he feared the consolidated government and the loss of states' rights. Not only Henry, but much abler men such as Mason, Benjamin, Harrison, Monroe, R.H. Lee were also opposed and debated others in what was the most acute discussion carried on anywhere. Kids today in school, they don't study any of that. They don't even study the Constitution. They think that the right to coin money is the right to print money. That's actually what it says in modern history books now. They're not even similar activities whatsoever. Owing to the way in which the conventions were held, which is in secret, the great opposition manifested everywhere, and management required to secure the barest majorities for ratification, it seems impossible to avoid the conclusion that the greater part of the people were opposed to the Constitution. It was not submitted to the people directly in those days of general limited suffrage. Even those who vote for delegates to the state conventions were mostly a property class, although the amount of property called for may have been slight. Now, I want you to understand that there are no property class in America today. When they refer to a property class, they're talking about people who actually own the land itself, in fee simple. If you read the book Covenants of the Gods, which is another book we have out, and chapter Law versus Legal, you'll see that you do not own any land whatsoever. You own legal title, but legal title does not include the beneficial interest of property. So therefore, you are not a property class, even if you own land. You're renting it, and that's why you have to pay taxes on it. Now, I'm not talking about anything complicated here. I'm just talking about things that people don't hear about. They don't study that, and they didn't teach these in the public slave schools, because they're teaching you how to be a slave. They're not teaching you how to be free. The Bible's teaching you how to be free, but the ministers have all absconded with the true meaning of the Bible, and they lead you back into bondage. And you know that one of the first guys to translate the Bible into English was Wycliffe, and he was not very popular with the government of his time, and certainly wasn't very popular with the church at that time. And he wrote in the introduction to his translation of the English Bible, "This is the book for the government of the people, for the people, and by the people." Interesting. Where'd we hear that before? Well, that's where Lincoln got it. He actually read that. He stole it from Wycliffe. But he wasn't telling you that the Bible was the key book for understanding free government. And you wouldn't know that from going to the schools that you go to. You certainly don't know it from going to the churches that you go to. So I'm a radical dude. I'm really stepping outside the box.
You are a radical dude, Brother Gregory, you are. I'm really thrilled to have you here at Freedomizer Radio. I'm just very excited. So thank you very, very much for bringing your depth of knowledge to us here and sharing it with us. We are at the bottom of the hour. If you don't mind, I will take a commercial break and
sure.
take care of our sponsors.
Yeah, maybe we can get some calls when we come back.
That would be lovely. Our phone-in number is 347-324-3704 if you'd like to call in and talk with Brother Gregory. And we'll be back in just a few moments.
Sure, are we back?
Oh, goodness, that one didn't go through. Yeah, yes, we are.
Okay.
We are.
we can't stand that dead air time.
Yeah, well, my studio just stopped, so we're back.
Okay.
We don't have any callers at the moment, but there was a question or a comment in the chat room about, and this is something that I've seen a number of times in various groups, is talk about maritime law and how that affects us, or does it. Do you have any insight into that?
Well, you know, I brought this up with my father at one time, and he went down and got the definition of maritime law and gave it to me, and this was years ago. He's passed away now, but my father was an attorney, wrote law books. And the problem, you know, of, you know, maritime law is following a particular historical form of law. There is one law, basically, the law of nature, and nature's God. That's one of the ways they refer to it. It's natural law, and out of that comes common law, which is what is common to the people. But it's true law is what they call right reason. It also includes divine law. And we go through trying to cover all these different labels that people put on different types of law. And maritime law, in essence, was a law of the sea. It was a law that was created supposedly within the framework of the law of nature, but not common law, because it was moving from land to land, and the common law is based, it's a land-based law based in nations that live on the land, while the law of the sea will touch harbors in many of those places. So therefore, they needed this kind of maritime law to conduct themselves when they're not on the land. And that was following certain principles. It is very similar to what we call equity. And it's kind of followed equity more than anything else. And part of the reason why is because of the fact that equity is something, equity is not law. Like I say, Bigelow writes that equity not being law winks at the law because it looks like law. It's part of a legal system. And equity and maritime law are very similar in many ways, because a lot of times equity is dealing with things like trusts and bills of lading and things like that, that you, where you're actually carrying somebody else's goods on their behalf, and then you're delivering them to a place, and et cetera, et cetera. So equity deals a lot with that, and so does maritime law, because that's often what maritime law, merchant law, all these things are legal systems that are created within this original basic natural law or right reason. You know, I've looked at these arguments where people say we're under maritime law, and it certainly looks that way from a lot of point of views. You'll see lots of parallels between maritime law and what you see going on. But I think it's more accurate to say that we're under administrative law, which, again, will function a great deal like maritime law. And when you look at the tracks, you know, you'll say, well, that certainly looks like maritime law to me. It's kind of like tracking a wolf, or am I tracking a big, huge dog? The track's going to look very similar. There's going to be slight differences. But I think that rather than get carried away with fighting this maritime law procedure and stuff like that, and I'm not going to fault anybody who uses those strategies, but it's not really a solution. It's an endless battle. And I think that, you know, Christ was realizing this, Abraham was realizing this, Moses was realizing this. So their strategy was to prepare the people to live as a free people. And something bizarre takes place when you start doing that, when people really start having that spirit that is necessary to be a free people. I think it was Adams who wrote, "While the people are virtuous, they cannot be subdued." But when once they lose that virtue or their virtue, then they will be ready to surrender their liberties to the first external or internal invader. And he actually uses the word invader there. And you'll find that in Samuel Adams' writings back in 1779, which is, you know, right at the time that these things were all taking place. This idea of becoming those virtuous people, the Bible goes into that, the slothful shall be under tribute. Slothful in what? Slothful in being virtuous people. You'll find in lots of other places, I mentioned Richard Henry Lee, R.H. Lee, who was in opposition to the Constitution. He says it is certainly true that a popular government cannot flourish without virtue in the people. And when he says popular government, he's not using the word popular like we use it today. He's talking populace, a government of the people. It cannot flourish without virtuous people. And, you know, this is what the kingdom of God is. It's people with a certain amount of moral integrity and virtue. They're not imposing morals on other people, but they themselves have that moral standing and character. And if you strive to develop that and come together as a people, caring about your neighbor's rights as much as you care about your own, it doesn't really matter whether it's maritime law or equity administrative law or even mercantile law. You will be guided in the right things, and you will be rejected. They won't want you in their courts. You will actually have a power that will be literally unseen. And I could tell you stories that most people probably wouldn't believe. I've been in court many, many times, not for myself. Maybe someday I'll be dragged into court, but so far they haven't done that yet. I go into court because other people get into trouble, and they ask me to come there and be there. And I don't fight in the courts, although I've talked with the judges, but I've gone there and just been there. And just what I call it is bringing this Holy Spirit into the room. And they end up addressing me sometimes. And with remarkable effect, where they are literally subdued. And I'm kind of a disarming guy, I guess, somehow. I don't think of myself. Some people think I'm pushy or I don't know. I get a million different descriptions of what I am. I guess I'm a lot of things to a lot of people. I wrote this article just recently, and it talks a little bit about this Occupy Wall Street movement. And I wrote an article, which you can find on newsofviews.com. You can also find it on our website at hisholychurch.org, which is the name of is Occupying the Chessboard of the Dialectic. And, you know, kind of a funny title. All my articles end up being something other than what you think they are when you start. But the reality is that evil wants you to resist it. It wants you to become an opposing force, but it wants you to do that on its level. You know, I'll tell you, here's an interesting trial. And it is a trial before a ruling judge. And it's actually the trial of Jesus Christ. And in it, he says a number of things. Now, he appears before Pontius Pilate. Now, most people don't understand why the Romans were even in Judea at the time. There were, I mentioned this in the last show, I think it was, there are pirates in Libya. From the halls of Montezuma to the shores of Tripoli, that's a song about Jefferson sending the Marines over to fight the pirates in Libya. Ronald Reagan sent the Air Force over there to fight the pirates in Libya. They're over there messing around in Libya now, supposedly because of this pirate-type government, which actually, that's all a lie. It happens to be sitting on a giant aquifer, and they were about to monetize all the wealth in Africa in a Libyan denarii, golden denarii, which would have killed the U.S. dollar, and they had to stop them from doing that. And so they demonized Gaddafi and went after him so that everybody would be distracted. Same reason they went after Saddam Hussein was because he was about to monetize his oil in euros instead of U.S. dollars, which would have collapsed the dollar. And they're trying to put that off as long as they can. But anyway, back to Rome was over there because the Libyans were sending out pirates attacking their trade ships. And the law merchant and maritime law said, well, we can go stop them. And so that's what Pompey was over there doing, is stopping these pirates in the Gulf of Sidra. And while he was there, he got a letter, a diplomatic letter from Aristobulus, who said he was the rightful king of Judea, and asked for Pompey's help. And at that time, Rome thought it should be the peacekeepers of the world, and they were out there doing all kinds of police work in every nation as peacekeepers. And Aristobulus offered him a huge amount of gold if he would come over and help him maintain his right to the throne. And well, he couldn't go, so he sent another general in his stead, and that general came there and put down the rebellion and put Aristobulus in power. Well, Aristobulus didn't like some of the other things that the general did when he was restoring order, and so he wrote a letter of complaint to Pompey, and Pompey comes and answers the letter by actually coming himself. And he says, okay, so what's the problem? And Aristobulus says, and he says, well, let's see the law. This is the way the Romans worked. They weren't imposing law. They wanted to know, what's the law of this place? What's the common law here? Now, they're judging what the common law there was based on natural law. And so they're looking at the Torah and the other laws, the Sanhedrin of its time, and saying, okay, so who's right here, who's wrong, and why? And through this process of deciding fact and law, he discovered that Aristobulus was not the rightful heir to the throne, that his opposing cousin, Hyrcanus, was. And he withdrew his support of Aristobulus and said that he would only support Hyrcanus because according to the Torah and the laws of that place, that rightful king was Hyrcanus. Well, he had already received all this gold from Aristobulus. Well, that would be a bribe. And so you know what he does? He takes all that gold that he had received to pay his troops for going all the way there and settling this dispute and gives it away to the poor because it's a bribe now. This was a bribe by someone who didn't have a legitimate right to the throne, and he withdraws his support. Hyrcanus says, I can't make a deal with you for support. Why? Because the Torah says, I can't look to you. I can't make a covenant with you or with your gods that you will support me. I can't make a treaty with you because there's no law allowing the king of Judea to make a treaty. And they're not supposed to do it. Now, we see many times in history they did that, and I can show you in Deuteronomy 17:16 that they're not supposed to have treaty-making powers. That was stated by Moses. If you're so stupid as you have to elect a king or a president or a prime minister, you need to write down in your constitution five things. And Moses listed them off in the Torah. So Hyrcanus can't appeal to Pompey for help. And Aristobulus is still around, but he's not fighting. He's actually held up in the temple. So guess who goes to Pompey? The Pharisees go to Pompey and ask Pompey, can you get Aristobulus out of the temple? Well, he's already read the Torah. And so he says, I can't even go in your temple because I'm not one of you. What do you want me to do? And they said, well, we want you to take him out. You know, and there's evidently some money involved and everything, but he wouldn't break the law. He says, so all my men, all my soldiers must wash at the laver before they enter the temple. They're instructed in the Torah, they're not to touch any sacred object while they're in there. This is what Pompey is telling his Roman soldiers. So they all go get baptized, washed up in the laver. And they go in, and Aristobulus flees out the back door. And there isn't any bloodshed there. There's bloodshed other places, but this is the kind of law that these guys are looking at. Now, why are they obeying the Torah? Because that's the law of the place. They understand law of contract. They respected Hyrcanus. Okay, now, fast forward up. They stay there for one purpose only, to find out who, I shouldn't say one purpose, the main purpose is to find out who is the rightful king of Judea. That's why they were invited in. Now, while there, Romans being Romans, they're trying to figure out how to make money, so they're building harbors, they're building roads to get goods to the harbors, because they make money over there. So the harbor, they got permission to do this, and it's good for business, and everybody loves the Romans. I mean, the Romans were loved by most of the people. Zealots didn't like them, but the Zealots didn't really like anybody. They didn't even like each other very good. But anyway, here we have Jesus Christ come along. Now, just before Jesus Christ, a guy gets to be king of Judea. Now, guess what? One of the rules that you had, if you're going to have a king, is he could not be a foreigner. And I always bring that up. There were five I said all together. I'll tell you real quick. They couldn't have treaty-making powers. They couldn't have a central bank. They couldn't have a standing army, because they're only to be defended by a militia, no standing army at his disposal. And they were to do nothing to return you to the bondage of Egypt. And the fifth thing is they could not be a foreigner. Of those five things, only one of them was put in the Constitution of the United States, and that he could not be a foreigner. And they evidently don't care about that.
That's evident.
Evidently, according to the birth certificate, you know, you got to have a birth certificate to go to public school. You got to have a birth certificate to get a Social Security number. You got to have a birth certificate to get a driver's license. But evidently, you don't need one to be the president of the United States. So that's the only job left over to my kids who don't have birth certificates. So anyway, and, you know, I pointed out before that, you know, this is why Christians got into trouble. They wouldn't register their kids. In 168 A.D., that was the probably the strongest official persecution of Christians was there under Marcus Aurelius, and it was because he made a law that everybody had to get a birth certificate within 30 days and register their children with the Temple of Saturn, which was their Bureau of Vital Statistics, and Christians wouldn't do it, and so they were heavily persecuted. Today, Christians do it at the drop of a hat because they want those benefits from those men who call themselves benefactors but exercise authority, something Jesus said not to do, but they all do it. But anyway, back to the trial. So Herod he wasn't Israelite, he was an Edomite, he became king, and he divided the kingdom up into three parts, and he put one of his sons in each of those parts, Philip in one, Herod Antipas in the other one. And then he had a third son that he put in charge of Jerusalem, who tried to usurp his own father's authority. And so his father had him arrested and asked permission of Rome if he could put him to death, because they had to ask permission of Rome to put any usurper to death, because they were there to make sure that there was no civil war. That if there was anybody with a claim to the crown, you couldn't kill them yourself. You had to go to Rome, because that's why they were invited in there as a peacekeeping force, an international peacekeeping force. So anyway, he got permission, put his own son to death, and then died. And there was nobody sitting on the throne from then on. And the one who had the right to the throne had fled to Egypt with his parents and eventually came back and was Jesus, and was hailed as the rightful king of Judea by all the people when he entered Jerusalem. He was called the Christ, Messiah, the Messiah, the Anointed, which was a title reserved only for the king. That's what David was called, the Anointed. And he was the king. He was ordering men in the royal treasury. If you read the Greek, it's very clear that he's standing in the royal treasury, giving commands to the ministers of that royal treasury. He's firing the money changers. Only the king could do that since the days of David. It's right there in your Old Testament. And your ministers don't tell you, because they haven't got a clue what they're reading, because they all went to brainwashing seminaries, and they never really started thinking for themselves. And so anyway, now Jesus is claimed king. They, the Sanhedrin, which was Congress, wants to get rid of him. They can't kill him. People say, oh, they couldn't kill anybody without permission of Rome. They were going to stone that woman to death. They stoned Stephen without the permission of Rome, but they couldn't kill anybody claiming to be the king. So they bring him before Pontius Pilate, Rome, to judge him, to judge whether he is the rightful king. And Pontius Pilate is about to sit in the judgment seat, and Jesus says, my kingdom's not of your world. The word he uses for world there means constitutional order or system of government. He's telling Pontius Pilate, I ain't got no contract with you. You ain't got no jurisdiction. Jurisdiction. You don't have any lawful jurisdiction. Pontius Pilate understood that and washed his hands of the matter. He was amazed. This guy knows the law. Now, your preachers in your churches, they don't know the law because they don't even know that that's the weightier matters according to Christ. He's saying, you ain't got no jurisdiction. And Pontius Pilate agrees that Jesus Christ is king. Thou sayest that I am a king. Later on, he's defending Jesus. He thought for sure that when he said to the Sanhedrin, you guys can kill one guy, the other guy you have to let go. You either kill Jesus Barabbas or Jesus of Nazareth. He thought they'd pick Jesus Barabbas, who was a zealot that had sworn their death and had an army. And no, they picked Jesus. They wanted Jesus crucified. And they wanted to set free the man who had sworn that he was going to kill all the Sanhedrin, or at least all the Pharisees of the Sanhedrin, which was most of the Sanhedrin at that time, that and the Sadducees, which he also swore he was going to kill. But they didn't want Jesus around because they realized Jesus was a greater threat to what they had going, because Jesus was going to disband the professional army. He was going to stop income tax. He was going to stop property tax. He was going to stop sales tax. He was going to go back to free will offerings in a virtuous society, or let that society drown, because that's the Torah. That was the law. Free will offerings only. You could not, and this is the way the early church operated, as a government, working daily in the temple, which was a government building. These are the men who do contrary to the decrees of Caesar because they have another king. So you want to be free as a people, find out what Jesus was really teaching and start doing that. And the funny thing is, it's legal in this country today. It's absolutely legal to have, you have freedom of religion in America today. What's religion? It's how you take care of the needy of your society. Social Security is a religious program. It's how you take care of the widows and orphans and needy of your society. It's not unspotted by the world, but that is what the Bible defines as religion, is how you do that. The way you do that in America is you give them the power to take from you. You owe income tax on wages and salaries because you have a Social Security number. It's not the 16th Amendment. It's not maritime law. It's contract. You have gone to the Pharaoh and say, take care of me if I have a need. And they have given you a federal employee identification number. You get hired by someone with a federal employer identification number. And now you owe a percentage of your labor to them. And that money goes to build the pyramid. Everything, all those burgers you flip in the morning at McDonald's, for the McDonald's, that goes to the federal government, all the value of that, and or wherever you work. And that's what's happened. You've returned to the bondage of Egypt. Remember, that was one of the items you were to put in your Constitution. They could do nothing to do that. You didn't put that in the Constitution. Yeah, you actually made this man, that give him the power to be the appointer of gods, the ruling judges from the top down. And now you have nothing but administrative courts, and in those courts they're going to ask the jury to take an oath that they will decide this case based on the laws of the what? State of Minnesota, state of Oregon, state of Maryland. Not according to your good conscience deciding fact and law. I won't take that oath. You know that oath is voluntary. it's not even in the statutes what that oath is supposed to be. They can't put that in the statutes. At least in most of the states I've seen, that it's not in there. It's not in there in the state of Oregon. And they called me for jury duty once, and that's where this all started. I said, I can't take that oath. I said, okay, no problem. Of course, I had to go in and tell the judge. What's that?
That's all you got to say? I can't take that oath.
Yeah, I'm not taking the oath. And they didn't actually want... Everybody else there took the oath. But they didn't make me take the oath. I just sat down. But I ended up in the jury box.
Oh.
And
oh,
nobody
God.
Asked me, how come you didn't take the oath? I said, well, I can't take that oath. It's voluntary. But eventually... Before they settle on the final juror, it's a big, long story, and I see we only got about 3 or 4 minutes left. But, that's what I should put in that book. That's one of the 5 books I've got in my computer that I should finish. We do not understand the law. And I understand a lot of people are working and trying to figure things out. Do not figure you've got it figured out. I don't figure I got it figured out. I'm learning all the time. But I've been at this for some 50 years now, learning all these bits and pieces with a great teacher. You know, we spell this out. You know, read the book, Contracts, Covenants, and Constitutions. Get on the Living Network at hisholychurch.org. Meet with other people. Start becoming that virtuous population that cares about themselves. You're going to need that one way or the other, whether you... You know, it's not going to make you free, but it's going to bring you in the direction. That's why Christ says, seek ye the kingdom of God and his righteousness. What is the kingdom of God? It's the right to be ruled by God instead of by other men, so that you have no other gods before the God in heaven. And that's really what it's all about. It's not about belonging to or some ritualistic, superstitious religion. There is a spiritual aspect to this. But there's it's talking about doing this in spirit and truth, worshiping the God, the Creator, rather than all these other men who would be God over you, who would be rulers over you. We were given dominion over the fish and of the earth and the birds, but we're not given dominion over each other. We have to become like Cain and Nimrod, Pharaoh and Caesar. And that's how they get power, is they get you to want to have your little power. You become a part of a vast bureaucracy, and we all become human resources because we covet our neighbor's goods. But anyway, that's it in kind of in a nutshell. But I was going to try to get through more of this. I think I have about 8 hours of audio on Contracts, Covenants, and Constitutions already on our website. Yeah, I'm pretty sure I do.
Very good. Well, I don't know if you're familiar with the children's game called Jenga. It's stacks of blocks, and you pull out different blocks to see if you can keep the tower from falling down.
Uh-huh.
Have you ever seen that game? Well,
no, I know of similar games, yeah.
Right. Well, that's the way I feel today. You've pulled out a whole bunch of blocks that I had stacked up in my mind, and I'm not really sure how well my little tower is going to make it in the very future. I've got a lot of reworking to do, so I want to thank you very much for...
Well, I am an iconoclast, but I don't want to tear down everything that people are thinking without replacing it with something of value. But the fact is to be free means, most of the bondage that we're in is dependent upon a bondage of the mind. And
right.
We have to let go of a lot of what we previously thought was true in order to find the whole truth. I just want people to keep stepping back and looking at a bigger and bigger picture, and then stepping forward in the right direction once you've got oriented on the map, so to speak.
Well, that's,
anyway.
That's one of the things that we're doing in the next segment, is we're going to be pulling apart people's perception of the money system. So if you have any time at all, we'd certainly love to have your input.
Well, you're going to be there for another 2 hours. I'm going to have to run for a little bit, but maybe I can get back in. I just call the same number, and you'll recognize my number? Or
I will.
Okay. I'll run for a little bit, and then I'll try to get back here in time to go on and maybe add to your call.
Oh, that would be lovely. Well, thank you very much for joining us once again, and we'll be happy, very happy to hear from you either later today or next week.
Okay. God bless.
God bless. You've been listening to the Sabbath Hour with Brother Gregory, and after this short commercial break, we'll be back with the rest of our programming.
You have been listening to The Keys of the Kingdom with Brother Gregory of His Holy Church. For more information on the educational ministry provided by His Holy Church and Brother Gregory, including services, counseling, lectures, books, and other audio materials, please write to His Church at Summer Lake, Box 10, Summer Lake, Oregon, 97640. You can also find us on the web at www.hisholychurch.net.